Well, let's get right now to Washington, D.C., our broadcast partner on the Catbird seat. We're talking about Ken Timmerman. And Ken, I know there's a race, a political race, that you have been watching very closely. In fact, you wrote a article in Frontline Magazine about how it's going to be a forest as it relates to, really, do the people have a choice in who they would like to elect? We're talking about the election for president in Iran. Talk to me about the race, and then I want to find out, how do they determine who the winner is? First, the race itself.
Well, this has been a highly publicized race between two candidates, the hardline preferred candidate of the supreme leader. His name is Raisi. He's a cleric. And then Rouhani, the current president, who in the past 2 weeks has had an election eve conversion. And all of a sudden, he has found himself a, quote, moderate. And as I like to joke with my Iranian friends, tell me how many times this moderate has saved a political prisoner from jail or has saved someone about to be executed from the hangman's noose. And they know the answer is zero times has he ever done that. Look, Jimmy, this is a farce, and it's a farce because the candidates are chosen ahead of time by the supreme leader and a committee that he controls. So only people are allowed to run for president who absolutely support the regime and its ideology and its aggressive stance towards both the United States and towards Israel. So when I hear people say that, well, we really have to hope that Rouhani is going to win, my response to them is, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. We've had Rouhani in power for 4 years, and what is his great accomplishment? That's the nuclear deal with the United States and our allies and Russia, the single worst diplomatic deal a U.S. president has ever signed. That's his accomplishment. He snookered us. And we think that's going to be better than the other guy? I don't think so.
Well, how do they go about then determining the winner when the vote is over?
Well, here's what happens, Jimmy, is that at about 2 o'clock in the morning, Tehran time, they get together with people from the Interior Ministry and those who are controlling the polling places, and they do a kind of sampling of the turnout, and they see who's come out in the areas that they know that favor hardline candidates and areas where they know favor Rouhani. And if they see that Rouhani has an absolutely crushing, overwhelming victory, and I would say over 60%, they might decide to declare him the winner. But if he has much less than that, I would be willing to wager they will affirm that Raisi won the election, just as they did with Ahmadinejad in 2009.
So both are for us, the vote and the final results of this election there in Iran and the election of a new president. Well, let's think about our president. He's going to be on a trip to the Middle East, and he's going to be visiting Saudi Arabia, Jerusalem, and Rome, Italy. Talk about that a bit later. But Ken, talk to me about the meeting at the White House between President Trump and President Erdogan. Seems like they were trying to mend their ties together, some strained ties at the White House. Not sure that happened. What are your thoughts of what did take place?
Well, that was certainly the intention of President Erdogan, and he also came to the United States, as we discussed last week, with a big agenda. He wanted to convince the White House either to turn over his primary political opponent, a cleric named Fethullah Gulen, who lives in Sailorsville, Pennsylvania, and he wanted the United States to drop the prosecution of an Iranian-American businessman in New York City, where he is being prosecuted in August for money laundering. Now, it's very interesting because he was laundering money from the Iranian regime and paying kickbacks to Erdogan himself. And this is in the dossier. That's why Erdogan wanted him that prosecution dropped. It didn't happen. I think it was a very frosty meeting. If you looked at the body language of the two presidents, President Trump was reading from a prepared script. It was not a glowing endorsement of Turkey, let alone Erdogan, whose name he did not even mention.
Well, indeed, it's going to be interesting to watch how Tayyip Erdogan and President Donald Trump, he and Haw together in this administration of Donald Trump in the White House. Let's talk about his travels to the Middle East. Looks like he's signaling a shift in Middle East strategy. In fact, his first stop is going to be Saudi Arabia. That is a very interesting development.
It's a huge development, Jimmy, and the Saudi king, King Salman, has pledged to bring to this meeting the heads of 50 Arab Muslim states to meet with the president. I cannot think of a similar meeting in the recent past with any American president. This is groundbreaking. And what we're hearing in Washington is that there's going to be talk of the United States backing an Arab NATO, an Arab form of NATO, so they can cooperate militarily against ISIS and other radical jihadi threats. I think that's a really, really big agenda item, and it would be a huge accomplishment for this president. Also, apparently on the agenda is a massive arms deal to Saudi Arabia and probably to some of the other Gulf states as well. I've heard figures as big as $350 billion of U.S. weapons to these countries over the next 10 years. That is absolutely significant. That also would be a big win for this president, as it will help to create more jobs in the defense sector in this country.
Hey, Arab NATO, talk to me about what would that mean as it relates to the Arab world.
Well, Jimmy, it would transform the way the Arabs do business, especially military business, since forever. You know, the past 60 years that the Arabs have had significant armies, they have generally fought wars alone, except when they're fighting Israel. And even when they fought Israel, as time went on, they fought increasingly alone. Now, if there was an Arab NATO with U.S. backing, with predominant Saudi leadership, it would mean you would have the armies of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, for starters, working together against targets like ISIS. It would also mean that there would be counterintelligence sharing on jihadi threats. I think this is also very significant, because it must be accomplished, it must be accompanied, in my view, with efforts by the Saudis and the Emiratis and others to restrict the recruiting of jihadists, of ISIS members in the Western countries, the United States and Europe, at radical mosques. The Saudis need to stop funding those mosques, and it'd be very interesting to see if that is actually on the agenda when the president is there.
When you talk about an Arab NATO, I'm reminded about 6 months ago they had a military exercise led by Saudi Arabia. Some 350,000 soldiers from 25 different Arab states. Wow, this could have some very important prophetic significance for the end-time scenario found in God's Word. Well, let's stay in the Middle East, Ken, just for a moment more. The United States accusing Syria of a mass execution of the people fighting against Bashar Assad in a crematorium near Damascus. What do you know?
This is a dramatic development, and it's from intelligence, apparently satellite photography and other intelligence that shows that early in the war, the Syrian government was using a notorious prisoner for political prisoners as also an execution site, and they had set up essentially a gas chamber, just as Hitler did during World War II, to murder some of these political prisoners, as many as 90 a day from some of the reports that I've seen. This just, again, reinforces the ghastly nature of this regime in Syria, and the reason why it is important for the United States, while not getting militarily committed so much on the ground against the regime, at least to help the Kurdish fighters there to battle ISIS and get some stability in Syria.
Two other items I want to talk to you about, Ken, not focusing on the Middle East, but the Far East instead. A war between the two Koreas is highly possible, that according to the new president of South Korea. Is that really a possibility?
Jimmy, that is a possibility. It's what the South Korean president himself, newly elected, has mentioned. They are worried of a war with North Korea, and they are looking desperately, really, for ways to calm the situation without, obviously, appeasing the North Korean dictator.
I've got to ask you this question, and a final question for you, Ken. United States Navy chief at the Pentagon wants a larger fleet to be able to counter the global powers like China and Russia. Now, China and Russia are major players militarily. Can a U.S. Navy combat that?
Yes, we have a lot of work to do. Over the past two administrations, actually the past three administrations, starting with Clinton, we have scaled down our Navy dramatically to where we're under 300 ships. It's the lowest we've been since 1919. And President Trump wants to ramp back up to about a 350-ship Navy. It means a big shipbuilding project has to get underway. It needs additional funding from Congress. There's not enough money currently in the military budget, but the Russians have invested tens of billions of dollars in new ships. So have the Chinese, and we are falling behind.
Ken Timmerman, on top of every story, I request for him to give us insight into when we talk together on a weekly basis. Ken, thank you so very much, my good friend. Know you have to rush into Washington, D.C. We'll talk to you again next week.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jimmy, and God bless.